So my name's Sadie Creese, and I'm a professor of cybersecurity here at Oxford. It's good to see you all here today. This, of course, is the advanced cybersecurity course. I'm hoping you've all just... Yeah. And only for those of you with PhDs in computer science. Right, you've got the right room. So I'm planning on talking for about 45 minutes, but I'm more than happy for you to ask questions as we go through and be as disruptive as you want to be, so long as you respect me if I tell you that the answer's coming in 5 slides. Right, so to set a bit of context, I'm sure I don't need to tell you the degree to which computers are completely permeated in our lives, every aspect of what we do. I'm guessing everybody here sends an email from time to time. Is there anyone that doesn't? No one's managed to completely extract themselves from cyber. There was a hand somewhere? Yes? Okay, I'm guessing though you might drive a car or carry a phone. I don't know where I'm looking. Yeah. So you've got some computers going on. Well, the truth of the matter is actually, even if you think you have in your personal spaces minimized your dependency on computing, the entirety of society pretty much depends upon it. We wouldn't have food on the shelves of our supermarkets without computers. We wouldn't get our comms. There would be no planes in the sky. Everything would pretty much grind to a halt. And that's kind of worrying at times, particularly if you research cybersecurity, because you can, if you let yourself, become a bit paranoid and a bit scared about the environment and wonder why we're not all giving up moving to Cornwall and living off the land, which I do think about at least once a year. But I ask you to accept the premise, therefore, for the sake of today's talk, that computers are pretty important to the way in which we live our lives. In fact, the situation is that this is a global phenomenon, and that as we, even here and now, observe the way in which people are beginning to live their lives and how we see the future projecting itself, it certainly is beginning to make no sense to any of us to try and silo this off. So up until recent years, people studied computer science, they studied technology, and other people studied society, and other people studied international relations and philosophy and ethics. And what we see now in modern times is that you have to somehow understand how all of these things connect. And it's in that connection that we can begin to understand the risks that we get exposed to from cyberspace and how we might begin to manage and mitigate those risks in our lives moving forward. Now, I currently sit on a Chief Scientific Advisor's advisory panel on the impact of the Internet of Things. And one of the futures we see coming our way in the Internet of Things is one where the world is so dramatically complex and so extreme in terms of nano and large scale that the future in terms of the holy grail of research in cybersecurity has to in somehow understand that complexity. And today I'm going to try and explain to you the nature of a cyber attack and bring to life for you the here and now. And I'll tell you as we move forward some of the areas in which I'm personally involved in research and why we're involved in that research. And hopefully by the end of the session, you'll have come on a journey and you'll feel that you understand what a cyber attack really is. So we can work with some definitions, and as you can imagine, there are many definitions of cyber attack available to you. Wikipedia may or may not be your friend, Google may or may not be your friend, but this is the definition we work to in my group. And here we focus on the fact that a cyber attack has to in some way involve some form of digital or electronic transmission, and it seeks in some way to disrupt, steal or corrupt some form of digital asset. And we use the word asset, it's a fairly benign term, to capture almost anything that we care about that's been digitized in some way. And I mean that as individuals, and I mean that as organizations, and of societies, and frankly of the human race now. So for example, if you were to attend Davos and you were to attend a workshop on how we feed the future billions of humans on this planet, you would be surrounded by people that would be talking to you about new ways of farming the earth. And those ways of farming the earth involve computers being monitored by satellites, tweaking the way in which we fertilize, etc. And so a cyber attack in that context would mean a hack into that system that would somehow change the way in which we're putting nutrients into the earth, perhaps to the point where you might create a situation where someone were poisoned if they were to consume it. That's a what if. That's the kind of thing that we might worry about. This microphone situation's... Yeah, okay, forgive me, right. Stand up and wave if you can't hear me. I'm going to do my best. Okay, so think of these assets in the broadest sense. All of us that in some way use online banking, we have some cyber assets. That would be the identity we use to access those banks, and that would also be actually the digital money in which we're dependent upon. So in the security world, in order to protect ourselves from any kind of disruption to our ability to access these things, or anyone taking it away from us, or in somehow corrupting it, we worry about a number of properties. And we design our solutions and our systems to ensure that those properties are maintained to the best of our ability. And of course, they aren't always. And those properties are confidentiality, that only those that should be able to can actually read or access this stuff. Integrity, only those that should be able to can change it. And availability, so it should always be there when we need it. And that would be true of you in the home, or you in your iPod on wheels, cars, today. And that would be true of people in the workplace who are dependent upon remote access to documents that they're working on, etc. So that's the definition we work with. And I'm going to take you through a number of attacks from the last 24 months. I'm going to actually hold this like this. That's okay. By the end of this talk, I'll have mastered the microphone closing issue. Yeah, somebody should have said wear a suit, right? Anyhow, so... this is a classic malware attack example. In fact, marks go to anyone who can guess which one this is, because it's been pretty big in the press in recent times, and I'll explain why. So, back in 2013, a company had what amounted to a digital card skimming scam piece of malware inserted on all of its point of sale devices. That this basically means anyone making a purchase in that environment had their debit card or their credit card details stolen digitally. It cost an absolute fortune. Now, what was fascinating about this particular case is, first of all, we know the malware was inserted onto the point of sale devices, so it probably came from somebody in the company's organisation at one of their in one of their buildings, likely an insider. But what I can tell you about this case is, as it played out, and it's very unusual for things to play out this way, it seems to be the way in which the future will look, what we found was an admission, first of all, that there was a security monitoring system looking at their systems. It was the other side of the world. And in fact, there were some alerts raised when the malware was inserted onto the system, but there are so many alerts raised in that day, it wasn't the one that got dealt with. The consequence of this, because of the scale of loss, was that various investigations were taken, and in the end, the CEO was forced to resign of this incredibly large company. Has anyone got it yet? Yeah.
Target?
Yeah. Yeah, and it's playing out in the courts of law, because everybody's pointing the finger as to who was to blame. So, what's a piece of malware? It's a piece of software that's designed to reside inside the system with malicious intent. Malware. Software. Malicious software, malware. In this case, it's not actually exploiting any kind of technical vulnerability at all. It's just residing on the system, it's a valid piece of software, and it's collecting data. It just so happens that it's data that belongs to people's payment cards, and somebody's there to collect it and give it to someone who can then defraud these people. So let's move on to another one. This is a social engineering attack. This is really fascinating and quite scary, in fact. And what you'll find is an awful lot of cyber attacks are not reported. And I've worked in industry, I've worked in government, and then I came back to academia. And I can tell you, possibly 15 years ago, we were witnessing very large attacks on very well-known brands that never made it into the press. People were so fearful of the loss of confidence that it wasn't discussed. And actually, consequently, an awful lot of attacks looked like blackmail attacks. People would hack in, they would encrypt the database, and basically sell the key to the organisation. So they would turn their critical data into an unreadable format without this key, and these organisations would pay a lot of money to access that key, and it was all kept very quiet. And in the last 10 years, so many people are getting hacked from the outside, it's become culturally acceptable. I doubt any of you would be particularly surprised or concerned if your bank, if your water supplier, your energy supplier, your local council, your car manufacturer, etc., were to admit that people were trying to hack into their systems. It would make the press, it probably wouldn't make anyone sell their shares. It would be acceptable. We know there's bad people out there. What's less acceptable are people from the inside trying to compromise these systems. It smacks of a loss of control in terms of the company's management. Well, this is a very scary attack. In this particular case, and it was a French-based multinational, what happened was a PA working to one of the directors of the board got sent an email. And that email was an invoice payment request. And this would be normal for this person to receive it, and they would normally push it through the normal payment processes. But it got followed up by a phone call. And the phone call was somebody that sounded totally valid. They spoke in the local accent. They claimed to be a director of the company, a very valid director. You could look it up on the directories and they would be a real person. And they put an immense amount of pressure on the phone to push this invoice through for payment. And as soon as the PA attempted to push it through the system for payment, what actually happened was a Trojan piece of software. So an unexpected piece of software was loaded onto that system that connected to a remote system via the internet and enabled what we would call the exfiltration of data, basically the pushing of data belonging to that company to the outside world. That's incredibly scary because the PA is just doing a valid job, the job that they're required to do every day, and they get a phone call and have the pressure put on them. It's not unlike if you get a phone call from somebody claiming to be in the technical team of your bank and saying that they're concerned about your bank account and could you please share with them, just confirm who you are, could take you through some security protocols. It sounds valid. And that's why people engage in these interactions, but it introduces you, and in this case, a very large corporation, to an enormous amount of risk. This is completely different. The disgruntled sysadmin and script kiddies were the focus maybe 5 to 10 years ago. So what's a sysadmin? It's the person in an organisation that essentially controls the technology systems. So they would determine what your username was, and they would manage the passwords and make sure that they were the right strength. And they would determine who had access to what at any one time. So they're pretty powerful beasts in general, sysadmins. Right, and they're usually incredibly knowledgeable, of course, that's how they get recruited. So they know their way around the systems. Unfortunately, this means, of course, if a sysadmin wants to go after something in an organisation, the chances are they will get it. In this case, there was a very small firm, and it grew over a period of 10 years to a very large, successful firm. And this system administrator had been there from the outset. And this is all about the psychology of people. And this particular system administrator had a really influential role in terms of the way in which the organisation went about its business in the early years. But naturally, as the organisation grew, their role diminished. They become far more focused on their sysadmin job and not on the general strategy of the company. And they didn't suddenly know all of the customers, and they probably weren't on first name terms with the board, etc. So they became pretty fed up. And at one point, actually, physically hit somebody. And at this point, of course, you get taken through some HR procedures. And the HR procedures resulted in this individual being fired. But once they had a look at this individual in those procedures, lots of people came forward and said, oh, yeah, they've been really unhelpful. I mean, some of my projects, it's almost like they get in the way. I can't do anything, and I need to have access to this system or this piece of software, and it's a week late, and it's like they want me to fail. And so they realised that they'd had a near miss and that they'd got rid of somebody who was far more trouble than they had previously thought. And then a short period later, the technical team start getting phone calls. I can't get onto my software today, and I'm working a project. oh, okay, well, we'll look for the backups. Backups aren't there. And what they suddenly realised when they investigated was that a logic bomb had been timed to go off. So the sysadmin had left them a present. And this logic bomb was a piece of software that at a certain point in time started deleting stuff. And it deleted so much stuff, they lost $10 million recovering from this situation. I'm going to do one more before we talk about the general form of cyber attacks. This is the opportunistic employee. This person, it turned out, resigned abruptly from an organisation, and they were fairly senior. People wondered why on earth they'd done it. And so they asked around, and there was some unusual behaviour recorded. Somebody in the technical team thankfully thought on their feet and said, let's have a look at what they've been doing on the system in the last few weeks. And what they found was, first of all, temporary files have been removed. Now, I'm not sure if you know what I mean when I say temporary files. So let's say you fire up your word processor or your internet browser. Well, any software application, typically when you're engaging with it, creates its own temporary files as it goes along. This is information, metadata it needs to support what you're doing. You're never designed to see them, but it's a footprint. So if you're somebody on a system doing something that you don't want anyone to find out about, you tend to clean up behind yourself. But if you're a forensic person and you see evidence of cleaning up, then that rings alarm bells. So that's what happened first of all. And then they found a program designed to copy extremely large volumes of data, and then the panic set in. And thankfully for them, they phoned the police really quick, and somebody discovered that this individual was booked onto a flight out of the country. They got to the airport, they intervened, this individual was carrying large amounts of corporate data, and after all of this, so they were prevented from leaving the country with it, and somebody thought to have a look at them online in their social networking environment, and it turned out they were working for another company in a very similar role, in a competitor essentially. And nobody had discovered this until then. So there's all sorts of attacks, and I'm guessing that you'll be familiar with lots of high profile ones on the internet, and maybe you'll be worried about your online banking, etc. Well, what I wanted to explain to you today is this is a very simplistic model, and we'll work up to some more tricky ones. But there's a number of phases involved in any kind of attack to greater or lesser degree. So whether somebody's trying to steal your identity, or whether somebody's trying to hack into Oxford or hack into the UK government, they start off by engaging in some reconnaissance. So you have to survey what it is you're about to attack. That makes sense, not just in the cyber world, but in any world, sadly. And you find your route in. Sometimes it's via an individual. Sometimes it is by luring somebody into giving away some personal details so you can pretend to be them. One of the most effective ways of doing that, still, in spite of lots of educational programs, is in a corporate environment to go give away free USB sticks, which have lots of malware on, and as soon as somebody plugs them in, away you go. And you may have spotted at the last G20 and page 3 of the broadsheets that some of the delegations, not the actual ministers, but some of the delegation participants from a variety of countries were given phone chargers, mobile phone chargers, that were loaded with malware that were designed to give somebody the ability to monitor the comms in that environment. So this goes on all the time. But to do this, you need your reconnaissance. You need to know how you're going to get in. Is it via a member of staff? Or if you're just a Lloyds Bank customer, is it trying to work out if you're a Lloyds Bank customer or not? You do your reconnaissance, and then you work out how you're going to exploit this. How do you get in? So it could be, I'm just going to send out an email to anyone on Google Mail and hope that they bank with one of these banks. And I'm going to hope they fall for my attack. We call this phishing, because we're just sticking some bait on the line. We're not really targeting very much. We're just hoping you fall for it. It's a numbers game. Generally, some people click on these things and share their details, and enough is made out of that to make it worthwhile. In other environments, we might be extremely targeted and focused. So you may be in a significant position in an organization, and somebody might spend an awful lot of time trying to work out how to strike up a conversation with you and find out what you know. And then we build our exploits, and our exploits are typically some form of malware designed to exploit some software vulnerability in the system, or They're designed to exploit some valid identity credentials that have been harvested. We'll talk a bit more about that in a moment. We deliver our payload, whatever that may be, and the attack concludes. Now, of course, this is vastly simplified. And in fact, in many instances, people will go round and round that loop. So here's a slightly expanded model to give you an example of something that perhaps you will be worried about, or perhaps you have been told you should be worried about. So this is a Hewlett-Packard 2011 example of somebody seeking to harvest identity credentials in order to access a corporate system and get some data out. So first of all, they're using social networking at the top, work out who's who works for the enterprise. In this case, get them to take ownership of a USB with an interesting attachment, and then move down, because as soon as the USB is plugged in, then the back door's opened, so they move all the way through to delivering the payload and removing the data. There's a very good example from a number of years ago where people are often unwittingly taking part in these things, and the lights went out in an American state. In that particular example, what happened was a contractor went in with their laptop, and as soon as they connected it into the system, some malware got into the system and the whole thing went down. And the reason why the malware was there was because the night before the kids had been online on the laptop. Happens a lot. it's tricky. So we have this situation and it feels so huge and complex that you almost wonder why on earth we would research this. It just sounds dramatic. Like, why would you bother worrying about it if all this bad stuff's happening and it feels like there's nothing you can do about it? And the challenge we have is we have really intentful people with malign ends, and we have lots of people, lots of us, that can help them reach their ends. And we're almost like tools in the toolbox of an attack. This is a very interesting model developed by Lockheed Martin to capture something that was commonly referred to as an advanced persistent threat. That actually means somebody's got access to a system and they've managed to stay there for some time. Now you can imagine, if you manage to stay inside a system for some time, you don't just get what you may have intended to get when you try to get in, but serendipity occurs in some cases. You discover some other stuff you didn't know that was valuable and of interest to you or to someone you might sell it on to whilst you're there. So in this case, we see reconnaissance, weaponization. Of course, this is aimed at governments and large organizations. So construct your exploit, deliver it, install it, and typically with an advanced persistent threat, there's some form of command and control back out to the internet. And some of the really famous advanced persistent threats that were found about 3 years ago, you may have heard of one called Stuxnet or Flame, perhaps you didn't. They were really exciting to computer scientists because they were, Flame in particular, was an excellently engineered system. It was incredibly modular, it looked professionally done. And what Flame could do, it was actually what we would refer to as polymorphic. So it was opportunistic. It was intelligence gathering actually, and it watched to see what was happening around on the system. Oh, somebody's using instant messaging. Ah, reach back through my command and control network and download a payload that enables me to compromise the confidentiality mechanisms, and I'll record that and send it back. Oh, there's Bluetooth headsets in the area. Right, okay, how do we compromise a Bluetooth headset? And of course, this is all technical, this isn't a person. So it was a fairly impressive piece of coding and attack, and that's at this end. And of course, those kinds of threats and attack means are incredibly worrying. Stuxnet, for those of you that don't know, compromised the nuclear refinement facility in Iran. Now, the whole thing didn't blow up, but it did make things spin around a lot faster than they should have done, erratically, and then stop. And we don't know exactly what the purpose of it was. Some people believe it was a practice run, just to see if one could get into these systems and change the code. Other people think it was a show of strength. Look what we can do. You better be worried. But regardless, what it did do was open up to the press what's something that had been known about in security circles for many years, which is there are many large facilities dependent upon IT that have vulnerabilities that can be exploited that can have real physical consequences if things were to go wrong. So a basic taxonomy of a tax looks like this. You don't have to read it. I'll take you through it. There's lots of different kinds of attackers. And actually, this model has changed over the years. So when I first got into, cybersecurity didn't even exist as a label then. We used to talk about computer security and information security and network security. And in those days, we used to worry about things called script kiddies, teenagers in their rooms, seeing what they can do, and accidentally going to places which would raise a few bells. We would worry about terrorists and how they might be using cyberspace. We'd worry about other governments potentially, corporate espionage. But actually in recent times, you worry about hacktivists, politically motivated groups, and in fact, more and more disgruntled employees, that's actually annoyed employees on the inside who have valid access on a daily basis. They don't have to hack in through your firewalls, they're on the inside already. And there's all sorts of tools. Technology tools, what we would refer to as social engineering that derives and focuses a piece of technology, and lots of different kinds of vulnerabilities. Some of them are in the code, and if you have heard about the latest hygiene campaign here in the UK, where the government's talking about if you just patched your systems and downloaded the recent patches and stayed on top of things, 85% of attacks could be prevented. They're actually talking about removing basic software errors that can be exploited by external hackers. Unfortunately, of course, you must remember it doesn't remove the threat. It just changes the way in which they're going to attack you. So there are software vulnerabilities that we do know how to get rid of, but we have such large, complex pieces of software in our systems that it's very hard to stay on top of that. So there's a constant process in the professional community by which new vulnerabilities or software flaws are found and patches are constructed and they're distributed. And for most people, so long as you've got automatic patch download switched on, then you're as good as you can get in terms of preparation. Of course, if you're of particular interest to an attacker, either your organisation or you as an individual, then the chances are they will find a way to get in. And all of these things come together to form attacks. And over the years, this is actually a very old picture from Carnegie Mellon, but it's designed to communicate the fact that at the beginning of time of recording for this particular diagram, attackers were required to have an awful lot of knowledge. That's the high dashed line. And over time, what's happening is things are becoming de-skilled and easy. In fact, they're also freely available on the internet, some of these tools. And so the concern was that actually there's a huge amount of value and it's incredibly easy to deploy these things. But of course, this is awfully simplistic and the world has changed in the last 10 years. And what we've witnessed is a growing ecosystem of bad people and bad things. And so nowadays, you don't really worry about a single attacker. These are organisations, and you can go out and you can procure yourself somebody that will design this particular piece of coding exploit, and you can procure yourself somebody who's going to hang around in the bar trying to persuade somebody to take this USB stick and pop it inside of their laptop the next time they're connected to their VPN. It's actually very, very sophisticated, and there's an awful lot of value now in coming up and discovering new forms of coding vulnerabilities that can be exploited that nobody knows about. Because, of course, if nobody's seen it, you haven't got a patch. And these are worth an awful lot of money. There's an upside to this, which is, therefore, there is an incentive for attackers not to use their best tools. If you're on the dark side, you always use the easiest way in. Because as soon as you've got a way in, people learn about it, and they learn how to shut that door and to prevent it, and in some cases, how to detect it and watch for you doing it next time, or people like you. So the upside of the economics or the incentivization model for this is that, in general, it's the easy route that's taken. So you don't have to worry about really sophisticated pieces unless you're really, really, really valuable targets. But the vast majority of us, what's happening to us is we're falling for the obvious. We are clicking on the phishing emails and we are answering the phone and giving away our details. And sadly, we're doing really silly things. And you could stop doing those silly things. So, all sorts of figures floating around for how much it would cost you to procure yourself a zero-day exploit. A zero-day exploit is one that nobody in the world potentially has seen before. And that means you could probably use it to hack into a system. So on balance, the graph you've just seen needs updating. It should be three-dimensional, and we should be worrying about the fact that there are all sorts of different kinds of threats. And okay, for some, they're in the world of the de-skilled, the download. This is my how to create a piece of malware 101, and I'm going to push that out via the internet and see where it gets me. But there's also a small contingent of really highly skilled threats around in the supply chain. What I should say, actually, is in recent years, being a cybersecurity person, unsurprisingly, people are hitting me with incredibly sophisticated targeted phishing attacks. Some of these emails really play to your ego. And yeah, I mean, so now I have to take this really, really paranoid stance. I just will not open it. I won't open CVs that are sent from prospective students. Don't get involved in any of it, because some of it is definitely malign. So yet I remained an eternal optimist. And I think that, you know, the world is going to be greatly enhanced by cyberspace still. You could be, yes, you could be. I mean, in general, it's inside, not usually inside a PDF, but you could be. There are ways. So
would they be sending you a link to their website or something with a CV on it?
Possibly. There's all sorts of things they could have in there. They might be sending me a little piece of code that sits on my machine and talks to their machines every now and then, and is not necessarily taking you anywhere near a website. Yeah. So as a rule, I don't get involved, but it's only because I'm aware that people are interested, and I think they're interested because I'm meant to know about cybersecurity. In general, I'm just some other person, and I'm not representing some hugely interesting, high-value intellectual property.
But if everybody took that view, then the whole thing would grind to a standstill, wouldn't it?
Well,
if nobody looked at CVs, for example.
No. So I'm
back to the post.
Pass it on to somebody who can open it inside a sandbox system. And my system has all sorts of other stuff on it that I don't particularly want somebody to get hold of. It's not state secrets, but I'm also not interested in it going out to the door. Whereas if we open it in another system that's only used for doing things like that, then the worst that can happen is we lose something off that system. And so we have mechanisms. But practically speaking, I use one credit card when I do any shopping on the internet, and I can monitor that card easily, closely. I can prevent anything happening before it gets too bad. Just try and limit everything in terms of exposure. So, more bad news. Before we get some good news, there's some good news. Right, so, so something about the way in which cyberspace is growing and the way in which our appetite for new technology is just being maintained and in some ways growing at a pace, that means that there's really significant payback happening. So why are more and more people getting into cyber attack? And they are. In recent years, we've seen a massive transition of serious organized crime groups into cyberspace. So they were criminals anyway, but now they're very au fait with how they do this kind of thing online. And that's either selling you fake tickets to big events or harvesting your identity credentials and selling them to someone on the other side of the world who will try and take some money out of everyone's accounts before they get found. It's because there's payback at scale, and there's also a perception of anonymity. So there's perception that it's hard to attribute the actions in cyberspace to particular individuals, or at least harder than if you were to do it in physical space. Certainly in a court of law, making the link between even a fixed computer in a room and somebody that was in that room remains hard. Even if you had their fingerprints on the keyboard, actually demonstrating that they were the person interacting at that time, you would have to show that that was the most recent fingerprint and it was laid at the time at which the attack took place. In general, your best opportunity, if you're trying to catch bad people, is to catch them with their hands on it and to be able to demonstrate that at the time. So, but there's big payback, and it's at scale, because of course, if you get the footfall you would get in cyberspace is much greater. And as our dependency on critical national infrastructures, such as utilities, energy, banking, etc., and their computerization increases, so does the reward if you want to cause terror by compromising that situation. So do you remember the bombings that we faced many years ago? And in fact, the failed bombings in Glasgow, where two doctors drove into the departure lounge and it didn't blow up? Well, you can just imagine what doctors with access to medical systems could do in terms of cyber that would cause awful terror. So unfortunately, we're definitely facing an incentivization in terms of people that would use cyber attack to do us wrong. And one particular area of note, actually, is that of ransomware, because up until now, and I described 10 years ago, 15 years ago, very large organisations being hacked into and having their data encrypted. Well, what we've seen in the last 2 years is a move down to medium-sized organisations, and actually a smaller amount is charged. And in some parts of the world, they're happy with an £1,000 ransom payment, and they're doing it remotely. So they're the other side of the world. So you can't phone up the police and expect them to show up at the door and to prevent this from occurring. That's quite bad news, because if they're willing to take higher volume with lower payments, then there's more and more of us in that smaller organisational category. So, hence why we have to worry at a global scale. And if you look at some of the statistics, they're really quite incredible. So this is from threat reports from last year. And as you can see, this 70% here, that refers to the number of spear phishing emails that are open. So these are targeted emails, spear, rather than just general phishing with bait. Throw a spear. So the kind of thing where somebody knows the kind of stuff you're interested in, and they know that you're likely to click on that versus something else. I remember the days before cyberspace. No, you're too young, Sadie. No, I do. And back in those days, this stuff used to go around in pictures of pretty girls and downloadable executables that were attached to emails. And so the mantra was, don't click on the .exe and don't click on the photos of the, you know, she's pretty. Yeah, unfortunately, that doesn't work anymore. Not least because we all have many of us have smartphones, and the whole premise of that business model is to download the app, right? That's the downloading, the clicking on the .exe, using software from someone you have no idea who they are. So what's worrying us then? Yes, I've moved on to what's worrying us. But in terms of research, what's worrying us? So what kinds of things do we get involved with here in Oxford? Well, that's pretty broad. So I'll talk about just my area, and I'm based in computer science. What are the kind of things that are exercising us? And I'll take you through a few of them now. So first of all, we're very interested in the extremely small and the resulting systems. So the picture here is actually, is of nanotech engaging with blood cells, red blood cells, in case you're not familiar with that. We're very concerned with the ability to create malware on this level and our ability to even know it was there and its ability to move around systems. And as the research community around the world develops an understanding of nano, how you manufacture it, how you manage it, how you keep it powered up, etc., then we're worrying about the potential for that. We're also worried about the way in which people understand themselves and the systems and they engage with the systems. That's the image on the top right. There's a big piece of research called Superidentity, and in a minute I'm going to give you a little bit of exposure to some of the early results on that. We work on metrics and models. We work on trying to understand what the DNA of a secure system might be so that we could actually replicate that and advise on that. We try and work out which of the risk-controlled ducks we should really line up and which ones we should shoot down, like in a fairground. And we're very worried about what cyberspace actually looks like as an environment and what that means for those of us engaging with that environment, whether that's as individuals or at work. So I'm going to take you through four key trends that are changing our research and keeping the security professional community exercised and in jobs. So the first of all is move to the clouds. And I'm guessing everybody's heard about cloud computing to a certain extent. Here in the UK, right, we have G-Cloud. We were interested in cloud computing many years ago when it first arrived on the scene as a concept and wasn't really being delivered in commercial products. The reason why we're interested in that is because it changes the locus of control over digital systems. And so we did an awful lot of research trying to predict which parts of the cloud would be attractive to attackers, what kinds of attacks we should be anticipating having to address, and what that would really mean for us. Now, there's a number of security concerns that have developed in the community since, and many of them you can address using standard controls, and they range from things, unsurprisingly, like privacy compromise. If I put all my data out there, my photos, my emails, my designs for new manufacturing products, etc., who might have access to it? But also, can I always access the cloud? Is the cloud always up there? Will it provide me with what I need? And am I going to get locked into a particular cloud, or am I going to be able to fly between the clouds and take the benefits of the different pricing structures, etc.? And I'm not going to take you through all of those because they're not all that interesting. I can take you through a few of the future attack scenarios that some of them we are actively researching defences against. So first of all, let's pick Trojan clouds. A Trojan cloud, what would that look like? A cloud that isn't what it claims to be. So in this case, a cloud that's set up, designed to look like a really valid commercial supplier, gets inside supply chains, because of course what you need to remember about cloud computing, you can switch it on and off, you can consume its services as and when you want it, you can use it to secure your photos as a backup, so it's always there. So if your PC at home, if it gets burnt, somebody pours a pint of water on it, you lose all the data on the PC, you know you can buy another computer, hook it into the cloud and download it all again. Beautiful. And it's there for a reason. And that's excellent. That kind of resilience in our lives we need. But imagine if somebody in that cloud's back supply chain, because that cloud has its own resource hotspots, if we all, do you remember back in the day when they used to be able to predict when we were all going to go and make a cup of tea in between, I don't know, the Christmas movie or EastEnders, I can't remember which one it was, but they used to be able to plan for upsurges in demand of electricity, right? Well, I'm sure we still can. So the same is going to be going on in the cloud ecosystem, that people are going to have demand, whether that might be royal weddings, lots more photos being launched into the cloud, who knows. If you can get inside that supply chain and become somebody that is a cloud supplier that everybody uses, and yet you have other objectives, malign objectives, then you can capture lots of data. So that would be a Trojan cloud. A sticky cloud, however, is one that suddenly goes out of business and your data sticks to it. So you're stuck with it, you can't remove your stuff, but who knows where it was in the world? You phone them up, I want my stuff back, I want to go and use this cloud supplier over here, can't get them, they're not on the phone. Where's my photos? They're not there, they're out of business, they're sticky. And then we worry about covert channels inside clouds. So we're very concerned, actually, believe it or not, about insiders having access to clouds, because up until now, pre-cloud, you had to hack each organisation. So there's a certain work factor associated with that. But if you only have to hack one cloud and you get every single organisation using that cloud or every person using that cloud, there's some kind of incentive there. And if you're on the inside and you don't have to work out how to hack in and you have access to all this stuff, there's a big incentive there. So we've been very interested in what could be achieved from the inside of a cloud. And in particular, even if you manage to protect the data in the cloud on the hardware when it was stationary through some form of encryption, as it gets moved around that infrastructure, can we stand in the way? It's a bit like overhearing. If two of you are having a conversation, can I lean in and overhear what's being said? And then even though you've still got it, I've kind of stolen it because I know it. So I've broken the confidentiality. So we're very interested in, can you do that in clouds? So as people's data gets moved around the infrastructure quite naturally, could somebody put some kind of electronic ear inside that system in a way that would enable them to reconstitute it?
Can I ask a question before?
Yes.
The cloud, is that just simply a computer with great power and tons of memory? And if so, why is Norton, which is supposed to be one of the greatest defense to ordinary users like me, why have they produced a program which allows you, supposedly, to put all your backup onto a cloud?
Well, most clouds are big clusters of computers, but yeah, the effect is huge amounts of resource and elasticity in the way you can use it. And as I said, it's a really good way of putting resilience into your systems. If you back up into it, you are no longer dependent on your hardware here. Really good example of when this really would have been very useful. If you remember the Twin Towers attack, well, lots of what we've known about needing backups for many years, and mirror sites sometimes they're called. Well, it turned out lots of organizations had their backups in the other tower. And that's because when they assessed the risk, the chances of both towers going down were assessed to be almost minimal. And so what happened there was a number of organisations lost a fortune, and it took them quite some time to recover their systems. If they'd been using the cloud, whoever had access to that cloud, wherever they were working, could have just carried on. So there is a definite upside, and that's why we're still embracing cyberspace, really, isn't it? Why we still all do what we do. There is an upside. It's just how you manage the risk associated with it. So we're running out of time. So I'll pick another couple. Mobile. Well, the future is big, that's for sure. And one of the challenges that we work on in the lab, well, there's two really core ones that are driving people. One is, okay, we have to live with the fact that you're going to download stuff from people you just don't know who they are. So how can we understand what that code's going to do? Another is, if we can't understand what that code's going to do, how can we put it in a box, in a system, so that we limit what it can do in a bad way? And I'm going to move swiftly on to identity and social networking. Now, I picked this one to take you through in a little bit more detail, I promise not too much, because I felt that of all of the pieces of research I get personally involved with, this is likely to matter to you or somebody in your family or someone you care about or somebody you work with. Because somebody, if not you, but close to you, will be engaging in some way of social networking online. And there are some consequences that we're trying to understand. So we began our journey, I'm trying to think when it would have been, 2008. And actually our journey then was we were very interested in people's privacy concerns around the use of their personal data and the way in which they were sharing it. And the research that we conducted there was investigating how we can do better than blanket consent. Can we facilitate a world where we engage in dynamic consent over use of our data? That may mean nothing to you. So does this mean something to you? When you sign up to use something, or you visit a website and you share your data, and you have to click the box to say you read the terms and conditions, as a general rule, you're handing over blanket consents over what these services can do with your data. A blanket consent is basically you have the right to do what you want. Mine is yours. Have it. And in some environments, actually, like, for example, LinkedIn may have changed recently, but LinkedIn, which is a kind of professional networking online environment, you can send emails to people via LinkedIn. And some people didn't realise that if you use LinkedIn to send the email, then they even own the email contents and they could do what they want with it. Whereas if you had just taken a record of the email address and did it via some other account, you may or may not have given away those kinds of consents on the other account. So as a basic rule, we were driven by this notion that all of us have consented to stuff that we are completely oblivious to when it comes to what we do online. And that should be in some way concerning. And in particular, could we do better? Could we design a system that enabled us to take greater ownership of what happened to our data? And then, so we worked on that for some time, but then that led to this understanding of the fact that there's this bleed between our physical selves and our online selves that's quite complex. And in fact, a number of you may or may not have been worried about the amount that's known about you from your store cards. There was a classic incident in the States where a young teenage girl who was pregnant got sent some vouchers by a store targeting her for, I think it was actually vitamin supplements, but products designed to help people in their certain trimester in their pregnancy. And she hadn't told her family, but they saw her open them, and this is how they discovered that she was pregnant, which was quite tragic that this is how they arrived at it. And the reason why this had happened to her was because her spending habits were being monitored. And this is actually quite an old case. And in fact, in that dynamic consent work, we did a lot of outreach talking to people about what is possibly known about them through their online shopping habits and the like, and how they felt about that. And most people, when it bordered on kind of fully understanding their preferences to the point that somebody could predict what they would do before they were conscious of the choice they were going to make, that was quite unpalatable. And yet that's pretty accurate in most systems. And so we reached this point where we were wondering, well, how could this be connected across physical space? How should we understand ourselves across the two spaces, and how might people feel about that? So we created this data reachability model. And actually, the start of this journey was not, can we design all of these different algorithms for collecting data about people and working out what they're going to do? It wasn't that. In fact, the motivator for moving into this model was a press story about a wife of somebody who was running one of the intelligence services putting some photos on Facebook. And I don't know if you remember it, there's a big hoo-ha about, is this appropriate? Could you be giving away where they live and where they're going up? Right. And of course, to researchers, that's a little bit between your teeth. And in fact, what the team decided was, wouldn't it be great if we could disprove the hype? If we really take a long, hard look at what can be learnt about people, can we show that there are natural barriers, that this system is somehow self-organising, it's not as bad as it might be? So we came up with this model for identity. We understand identity as being exposed in different domains. Some of it's cyber, some of it's physical, some of it's to do with your psychology, and some of it's stuff about you, biographical, where you were born, etc. And that might be stored in a physical way or a cyber way. But there's stuff out there that can be collected. And that what we can do is design a mathematical model where we record in the model any claim by anyone that we can access that if they know A and B, then they can work out Z. And we just recorded that. And we spent about 3 weeks doing quite a detailed survey of openly available sources, research groups, industrialists, anyone online that was claiming that they could find out about you in some way. And we popped it into this model. And what that gives us is a graph. And we can ask of that graph all sorts of questions that you just do in standard graph analytics. But for example, if I have these pieces of knowledge about someone, what else may I potentially be able to find if I believe the claims in the world? Equally, you can start at the other end and say, is there any way, how would people have found this about me? What might I have shared out there? And what the model then did is we took the transitive closure, and by this we mean we look for every possible combination of these little jumps, these little identity leaps that can be made, and we drew this massive graph of people's identity and the connections that can be made. And then we started worrying about, okay, well, how would we calculate risk? So we need to have some understanding of how easy it might be to make those jumps and how accurate it might be. So, and here, this is quite interesting, it's probably about 18 months out of date, but that actually is three different visuals of the identity model. So all these little arcs, the little jumps between exposures of identity, and the stuff in grey was the stuff being hypothesised by the research community as being possible, but nobody had claimed it. The stuff in red, people were claiming and we were recording. And the stuff in green, we checked that it was possible. And you can imagine if you overlay them, it's quite complex. That's why I put it out for you. It's very dense. In fact, this particular graph drawing algorithm, what it does is it puts in the middle everything for which there's lots of different ways of jumping between these pieces of identity. So naturally what you get is a very dense picture in the middle and things that are hard to see around the outside, because the things around the outside, there's only one way of getting to them. So we got to this point, I think, and then we wondered about, okay, so what do people normally put out there in a social network and just how bad might it be? Well, there's lots of different ways of using social networks as attack platforms. I won't take you through the dictionary of different kinds of attacks, but nevertheless, people are using them already as sources of intelligence, but also they're putting inside these environments links to malicious websites, because there's all sorts of functionality offered on them. extremely popular, and there's big consequences for people. So certainly there's evidence out there, known attacks in the press, where people have, for example, burgled a house because they knew no one was going to be in. Now, everybody predicted this years ago. I remember working in something, we called it in those days pervasive computing, must have been 2003, and we were all worried about this future of loads of devices and what we might give away. It predated the big kind of push in social networking, but there are news stories, if you go and Google it, people who have actually been burgled, and the burglars said, this is how we knew to go around to that house. And that was just through their declarations on social networking spaces. I'm going out, I'm going here, I'm going to do this today. Of course, in the future, where we foresee these online fridges and smart tellies and smart garages, so you could open the garage door before you get home and put the kettle on, there'll be all sorts of other data that would enable someone to work out if you're in the house or not. And actually, if you're in the house asleep and unconscious, so they don't necessarily have to wait for you to go out, they just need to pick a time when you're unlikely to catch them. There's other consequences, actually, for what can be found out on social network environments. So very interesting results coming out of psychology research, which is telling us this, for example. The bonds formed online are typically stronger than those formed offline. So you can more quickly develop an intense relationship, an intense bond with someone online than you would have done if you met them in a bar. And this speaks to the fact that an awful lot of trying to find a way into an organisation, trying to persuade you to give away details, is being exploited through online. And obviously there's scary connotations when we think about our children and what they're exposed to online. And there's a huge blurring now between people's work and their social and their family lives. So we went about assessing this risk exposure. This will be the end of the story. And we conducted a couple of experiments. And of course, all of our research is governed by ethics. And so in this case, what we did is I found two people I knew that nobody around here knew and said, can I set my team on trying to find something out about you? So I'll give them your name. I won't tell them where in the world you work or anything more about you. I won't give them a date of birth. I'll just give them a name. And let's see if they can find out if you're that person, find you. Because lots of people with the same name in the world. So you do this with consent. I had two flags. We call them flags. This is a capture the flag exercise. So you say to the team, and bear in mind the team, these are really bright computer scientists, one of them with psychology training too, because you can see why we would do that. But they are not ethical hackers. They're not from the dark side, the good side, and they never work professionally. And I gave them the first flag, just the name. And this particular flag should know better, because they're in a security operations position in a very high-tech company that's worth a fortune. And they were the most senior operations person, which meant they were the person that could switch off the firewalls, switch off the intrusion detection, create the fake access account, basically open the door for you to get in. And it just so happened that because of the nature of the business, you would imagine that every aspect of their corporate IP was digitized, because they're just incredibly high-tech. Unfortunately, they're so promiscuous online, it was unbelievable, and I shouldn't laugh. And what actually occurred in this situation was the team were using the model. So they put the name in, and the model says, oh, you should be able to find X, Y, and Z. All right, then so-and-so claims they can do this. Let's see if we can do this. Let's see how far we can push it. And can we find this right person? And they, within about 4 days, suddenly this complete pattern of life came just crashing down, and I had to stand in the room and pull the switch, because it was family, friends, complete prediction of what hour of the day, where they would be, what technology they'd be carrying, what kind of conversation strike up with them. It was just completely gone. And so then we had to go and brief back and say, you're open, this is it. And in that role, you're also of interest. And this anything could be found out. Anything. So there we are. So the second flag, also interesting for a very different reason. This person, far more careful. But what had occurred was, first of all, they had a very much more common name, but because they were careful, there was an absence of a certain kind of profile, a certain piece of data around them. The fact that they were being more private than the normal made the team interested in them. And then they found this one piece of information, that linked their work life and their profession and their home life. And it put them geographically in a part of the world that the team knew I might know them. And it also made them look like they might be somebody who was interested in our kind of work. So a technology kind of person. And so they had a really good guess, and you know what, they got it. But that particular individual was able to go back and say, they'd completely forgotten about this piece of information. It was 5 years ago they'd stuck it out there. But they were able to go and kind of remove it, and one day the web crawlers will forget it. Well, nothing's really forgotten, but there will come a time when it won't come up in a search, and it's essentially gone from cyberspace. So this tells us some interesting things. First of all, in short, it's so much worse than anyone thought. Yeah, so, but well, but we're still going to engage in this kind of stuff. But we need to do it with our eyes open. So where's that led us? This is still a research journey. I'm sharing with you the research. I'm sorry I'm not sharing the solution, right? So we're not there yet. So there's a number of things we're doing. One is we're working on how we measure naturalness so that we can all better understand what we are like when we are online and what that might tell us about ourselves, and it might help inform us in terms of some of the risk controls that we should be engaged in. We're developing a self-assessment tool so that people, either an individual, a person, just you might want to know, given I've shared this, actually what could be found out about me. And equally, an organisation might be saying, well, members of the board, can we work with you to do this self-assessment, because we really don't want anyone to be able to target you that hard. So we're working on that tool. And we're also investigating how this might inform policy, public policy, around things like digitisation of your medical records and putting those into the cloud. So we're working on some analytics that would work on the graph that might be able to inform you if there's one thing you try and control, one step that you might regulate, prevent, go and advise, do public health warnings, whatever it might be, we call this breaking the arc, what are the game changers? So are there, if you imagine one key that opens so much of your identity, that really we should all be very worried about that, and that's really where we put our money and what we should control. Because it is so vast, we can't possibly hope not to give this stuff away. We want to engage with cyberspace. It's going to enhance our lives. It already does. But can we do better? Can we find the pieces that shouldn't be put together? And that has practical ramifications, because that means you don't join up those databases then, and you only join up those databases in a knowing sense, with consent, and you do that so that people know that you're doing it, those kinds of things. And more generally, and I will finish now because we've been going an hour, our focus is beyond just the identity, and this is really, really important here. The advice that we give anyone that would ask us about current cyber attacks and how they should perceive them is you have to assume you're compromised. There's no such thing as putting a wall up and stopping someone get in. So it's all about being able to ride the wave. What we need now is an ability to plan to survive and work through and not care. And at the really acute end, you want to put it all out there because bad things can't happen to you as a result. And that is driving an awful lot of research, right from very low level theoretical algorithmic approaches to working how we get systems that can tolerate intrusion, all the way up to how we better understand risk. Thank you. Any questions? And I'm sorry about the microphone.